I'm now in Detroit, Michigan, and do you want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Chris Alexander, 34 years old.
I'm Mike Ermler, 56 years old, if we're going to go the age route.
That's one way to do it. So we're in Detroit, which has pretty long, well-known radical history from, I guess, the 60s and the 70s, people would be aware of. But of late, a lot of the industry has left the town, and you know, people are probably also aware of that. You want to start by maybe talking a bit about, you know, what that history is?
Obviously, it was known as the Motor City, the center of the U.S. Car industry. It was a city in the 30s known, you know, inextricably linked with the CIO upsurge. It was a city that also saw, you know, large migrations from the South, including migrations of black people. And it was also a city heavily linked and part of the whole history of the black movement, the black liberation movement. And oftentimes the two intersected quite a bit. And that carried on through the 70s, but in particular with the decline started somewhat earlier but wasn't evident. And like when I arrived here in 73, within the city limits itself, it was 1.5 million people, and now it's down to 700-some thousand and collapsing, and it's had a big effect on the movements, people's, whether they think they can politically affect things. It's had a demoralizing, atomizing effect.
I mean, from driving around earlier, the collapse is quite literal. There's a lot of houses just falling down around the place. One of the neighborhoods we went through, you were talking about how it, you know, it used to be a real stronghold for the left, that there were, I think you were saying, there could be 15 meetings on, like on a Friday night or a Saturday night. Do you want to tell me a bit about that again?
Well, that was like in the 70s when I arrived here, and there was lots of young people coming up from the South, black and white, looking for jobs in auto, black people wanting to escape the conditions in the South, even though the civil rights movement had battered down explicit Jim Crow then. People were wanting to get off the farm, the backwater, get to the big city, get out of the rural areas. They were coming here. There was an equivalent thing even with from the upper South of young white people, but also we had a big influence, the breakup of SDS and other stuff like that, and a lot of the wing of the movement that, not entirely, but adopted some form of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, or in the case of the anti-Stalinist, overwhelmingly Trotskyism, numerous groups and parties formed and had people self-consciously move to the city to get jobs and auto. Some of it was, you know, due to the direct influence of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers struggle that happened and stuff. So there was a huge influence of serious left organizers, whatever the limitations and sometimes authoritarianism of their politics, you know.
And in terms of the city today, what would you say are the major kind of issues?
The unemployment, unemployment.
Decent housing.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Decent medical. Sometimes no insurance, no health care. The hospital here are overwhelmed, understaffed. In fact, there have actually been instances where doctors and nurses have organized almost kind of like spontaneous strikes and marches against various, the staffing deficiencies. You have the university, just going once more on the healthcare stuff, the universities are underfunded at times and they've entered into partnerships with the medical centers, but for lots of reasons they can't reimburse the medical center, so there's just one more kind of lack of funding, city worker stuff.
Well, there's the big cuts in city services, and the city workforce has shrunk under successive mayors, the constriction of the tax base, part none of the big industrial taxpayers anymore, but also the white flight, and more the tax burden's been put on, you know, the remaining working and middle class people. And constriction of services. Just under the present mayor alone, like my union, AFSCME, went just in the last 7 years or so from 6,000 members to 3,000. And then other issues around transit. There's a really shoddy transit system. And then, obviously, education. The schools are a disaster. And at different times, in an attempt to get out of the fix, the state has seized the schools, then reappointed the mayor as sort of like dictator of the school and eliminated the elected school board, and that kicked off a whole big wave of struggles with people wanting to restore to the right to vote on the thing. Obviously, the new and there's been a succession of factions winning school board elections, and none of them were with a program or an ability to do anything about the sad state of affairs in the schools.
Just this year, they're predicting a $70 million deficiency in public school funding. Basically, as you saw earlier driving around, the total infrastructure of the city is just falling apart or under siege. There's no funding. There's a lack of jobs to provide for taxes to redo that. Some parts of the cities have gone into receivership. But it's pretty bleak when it comes to what can benefit the city as a whole, what can benefit the class. I mean, we're just west of where there's been a lot of investment going on. I was saying earlier, like a 2x2 square mile area, you got casinos, you got the school, you got nightclubs, and it's really picked up in terms of people coming out at night. Like 15, 20 years ago, downtown Detroit, you would never see anybody really out. Now, on a Friday, Saturday night, especially with spring and summer coming up, sometimes there's traffic jams in the middle of the night. You have a lot more middle class and upper class people coming in, getting condos and whatnot in the redeveloped old auto and industrial centers. But once you get outside of that, it's just immense poverty. So all the investment that's going on in the center is not affecting and not benefiting the working and poor people outside and on the periphery of the city. And, you know, as you saw, houses are still falling down, and sometimes houses are falling down and people are still living in them. You know, it's very bleak. And that's not just Detroit, just getting off. I mean, you go across Michigan, the east, the north, going to Saginaw, Flint, parts of Lansing, some of the smaller auto centers, Jackson, all these places. It's kind of this mass effect that's happening. And then you got northern Ohio, Toledo, you've got other parts of the Rust Belt like Buffalo. All these old centers of manufacturing industry are just, they haven't been able to change with the time, and nobody's has an interest investing in it. So they're just really kind of falling apart.
And in terms of the issues you're talking about, are there any significant struggles in relation to any of them?
Well, like I said, there was the struggle around the control of the school board, and restoring the right to vote. That went on for several years, and it involved community factions in the teachers' union together, lawsuits, but it also involved countless disruptions of school board meetings and mass disruptions. You know, sometimes up to 1,000 people invading a school board meeting and carrying on. The right to locally vote on it has been restored, so that movement has basically disappeared with nothing in terms of quality to show for it. There's been attempts at resistance from the city workers, but the workforce is still largely demoralized, so it's been 100 here, 100 there, resisting and still constantly losing. Like in the last, since just the Christmas holidays, there's been at least 4 attempts at major demonstrations by city workers to resist the present mayor's policies, and he's also in trouble for some tech-sex mess and all other stuff, and there's a big faction fight going on at the city government level. feeling he's vulnerable and that he may try and impose another round of concessions on the city workers. People are after him, but limited numbers are coming out, and with the confusion and lining with what politician can get you, it's caused a division in the working class and black movement over it. So, for instance, there was a demonstration that's now been about 2 months ago where two of the public employees, locals, called it. There was some community group, participation in it. But it was met by an equal and slightly larger number of people from three unions and other black community political factions. And it had a real chance of breaking out into a major brawl, intimidations. There were some punches thrown, a nose or two broken, stuff like that. So it's part of the situation that you have potential outbreaks of fighting between unions. It's so crazy, unions that are housed in the same buildings and stuff. Like I had earlier told you, the bus drivers being in one camp, being in the transportation union, the bus mechanics in another, and somewhat which bourgeois faction do I line up on what plan to deal with transit in the city. And one of the things that's really lacking here is, as stuff goes down, people follow one faction or another that's coming from the elites. Plan to deal with whether education, transit, whatever it may be, the labor and community groups are not getting together, organizing themselves independently of the normal bourgeois politics and coming up with their own programs and plans that would unite the different factions and put a third voice and back it up with their independent power. That's just totally lacking and leading to the fragmentation. And
people who are interested and are hungry for kind of an alternative politic or something that's going to say something that's going to connect struggles going on in labor to the needs in the communities. While there are people and have been groups and individuals trying to, fight that fight and organize, by and large, people are atomized, and a lot of the unions aren't doing the work. They're not doing the work to reach out. They're not organizing, and they have resources, and they're still not utilizing that. So if that's not happening, if the unions who you think and the responsibles, the leaderships aren't taking that responsibility and organizing and making those connections, why are people going to come out? Why are people going to invest their time if they're not seeing any results or if it doesn't make sense? And so there's a real lack of an independent and political perspective, voice, and action. And with the anarchists around here and independent socialists and whatnot, a lot of people have become burned out, demoralized. They've tried different things. And so you go to a lot of these actions, and you don't see much of an independent or alternative perspective or trend or tendency. So
well, that moves me on to the anarchist movement in the city in terms of what exists. But historically, what has existed here?
The anarchist movement was here in the past, even though it wasn't explicitly anarchist in the historical IWW, played a role in the 20s and 30s here, though it was overshadowed by all the other left things, eventually the CIO. And there's been some important anarchist things in the countercultural environmental stuff in this city for a long time. For instance,
it's probably been the biggest in the 70s, coming out of the SDS, the 60s, 70s. You had like the Fifth Estate, you had a lot of the stuff around the Cass area, but from a class, more of a class orientation that was kind of lacking. And not that the countercultural, more countercultural groups didn't try to address those problems, but it wasn't necessarily a priority. It was kind of in the midst of all these other issues, and environmentalism and, dropout and smoke dope and rebel against the system in its entirety. But not really till the 80s
Yeah, well,
didn't start picking back up.
Well, in the '60s and '70s, the black movement and the more what you could call white left trying to become the multinational, multiracial left. I mean, Marxism held sway. I mean, and a lot of people who started as like black nationalists, who had a more working class thing, eventually adopted Marxism, Leninism, and stuff. And it was part that since those politics were ruling the roost in the Third World, and people were also identifying the fight against capitalism and U.S. imperialism as a fight against white power and stuff like that. Overwhelmingly, those movements adopted a Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, whatever, and not just the organizers and stuff. There was you know, it influenced a lot of people in the auto plants, things like that, and it was like, you know, and then there was also, you know, the Trotskyist left that didn't want to stay on campus debating some of those formations, sent people here and developed a practice. But the anarchist movement was basically a non-factor in industrial working class and working class community. It really didn't start to reestablish itself outside of the Fifth Estate and its collective stuff until people started moving out of the punk movement and stuff and started to establish some inner city houses, communes, some activity in storefront spaces. And it kind of tried to do some good stuff, but also kind of reveled in the post-industrial vision of we're going to live in the cracks and nooks and crannies and provide services in the nooks and crannies of the collapse, and everybody should start by getting their own household and corner together. So kind of had that.
One thing that may have fueled into that too, say around the early, late 80s, early 90s, is that parts of Detroit look a lot different now than they did even 10, 15 years ago. I mean, things were a lot bleaker then. You know, the city got hit with a major recession late 70s, going all the way up to the late 80s. You know, people just didn't, you know, putting aside people's not wanting to commit to a long-term strategy, whether it's in workplace organizing or whatnot, people didn't see much chance of this city coming back and that it would just continue to go down. In a lot of ways it has, but the developments in downtown are a little different. But, you know, in terms of the anarchist movement, things that really started to pick back up were kind of people making the move from the kind of the punk and skinhead countercultures to like doing, trying to engage on a broader level with people in various communities, in the workplaces people were at. You had anti-fascist campaigns because with the whole 60s and 70s experience, there were pockets of white communities, and that a lot of racist attitudes were there, and a lot of the more formal fascist groupings attempted to play on that fear and that those frustrations. And so, you know, you had groups like Anti-Racist Action that formed, and they were trying to actively kind of confront and shut down the fascist formations that existed around the city. You had people involved in anti-police brutality campaigns. You know, so those are the kind of things that ended up being the genesis for a renewal of the anarchist politics. You had a place that no longer exists, but right down the street, east of here, 404 Willis Center. And I don't remember how long that was there, but that was kind of an anarchist space for a number of years. And it kind of acted as an incubator for, you know, people meeting each other and those bridges between anarchism, anti-authoritarianism, and like anti-poverty campaigns and whatnot. And that all kind of percolated in 89 to 92.
And then ARA kind of came together in the latter part of the early 90s and went towards, that's here locally, I'm not speaking nationally or regionally, and it was probably, though not explicitly anarchist, the most important thing that came along, because besides the anti-fascist work, taking on resistance records, it ended up attempting, you know, there were demonstrations and rallies downtown, not only about stuff like Mumia, but about the building casinos and new youth prisons, but no jobs for youth, and you know what are you doing for people in the city but casinos and youth prisons. And then there was an attempt, the city here, which has always had like a social democratic liberal leadership and the Catholic hierarchy, backed this liberal social democratic living wage thing. It passed overwhelmingly on the ballot here, and while ARA and the anarchists weren't part of it, given the electoral thing, once it was in place but not being enforced, to have more contact with some of the poorer strata of the working class, ARA here went on a campaign of going through those workplaces, finding workers who weren't getting the minimum wage, living wage, which were supposed to, and started an agitation in alliance with some staff people from the AFL-CIO, and at different points, like invaded the city ombudsman's office with signed complaints and trying to get the thing enforced. But this also even led, wasn't the only issue, but led in to a splitting of ARA. We had some people in the group who wouldn't take part in it, saying since we were still a largely but not entirely white group and these poor strata were overwhelmingly black, even if, immigrant blacks in some case from the Caribbean and Africa, but black, that we were practicing a form of imperialism by trying to provide leadership to it. And these same people then just thought ARA's role should be in the local coalition against police brutality, just coming out and supporting whatever the leadership of that did, but didn't see building an independent presence. Though some of the people in it came afterwards and then admitted they came up with political rationalizations for being afraid to go into these sectors on their own, being afraid and guilty about the racial history of this country, about wanting to do that. That happened. And then we had another group of people that split out and seized one of the housing resources of the ARA group, saying we're going to set up an explicitly anarchist thing. ARA's too anti, just focused on anti-fascism, which was a valid criticism, but totally ignoring the attempts, to break out into this new stuff, no patience, and set up a more purely anarchist group with a publication for a while, and it was, and it had some life on its own and whatever, but it was part of the death knell of the earlier Detroit ARA.
Part of one of the problems, and it's not unique to Detroit, is that there hasn't always been a good practice when it comes to discussion and debate. There's a tendency for people to avoid it, avoid political questions, and just go, well, I'm tired of this, and strike out on their own and go do something else. That was a big problem. That was a big problem here. I wasn't living here at the time. I was actually in Chicago, involved in Chicago anti-racist action. But around the time that Mike is talking about, we had relationships with people in Detroit through ARA, but also through other formations like Love and Rage that was going on. And so we had a camaraderie, back and forth, but we saw some of the problems. But like I said, that's not unique, this lack of internal, even democracy, and I don't always like to use that word, but for these purposes, sure. It causes people to not want to hear other opinions and just kind of brush aside, and that kind of led to the end of ARA, one of the things. But at its height, ARA was having about 50 people, you could kind of say consistently were kind of coming around, and then had other peripheries. It was quite a dynamic group. But then what was going on here, coupled with problems within ARA nationally and divisions and debates. Once all that started to break through, there was no real course of action to kind of keep things together. And so kind of people went off and split off in different things. And at the same time that problems going on in Detroit and then ARA nationally, Love and Rage, which was at the time, the largest and explicitly anarchist, revolutionary anarchist, wanting to be pro-organizational formation, was itself suffering splits. And that kind of had reverberations even here on a local level, where even some people in ARA who identified as anarchists were not pro-Love and Rage, and then they didn't want to work with people in ARA who were Love and Rage, and it just got really kind of messy and factional. Everything kind of came to a head in about 97, 98 overall. And there have been attempts at other anarchist projects. But by and large, they haven't gone very far, or they've kind of retreated to whatever issue that particular grouping or faction or collective, you know, kind of, you know, thinks is important. A lot of people who have remained committed to the visions, but they feel atomized. They're not part of a functioning working group. They're not part of any kind of collective entity. They're not part of a protracted, like, dialogue around ideas. And because of that, a lot of people just don't even know what's going on elsewhere. So what they do, if they haven't, you know, if they're trying to remain committed to those ideas in an anti-authoritarian and a radical and revolutionary perspective, they often just kind of submerge themselves in whatever work, whether they're teachers, whether they're city workers, what have you, and they attempt through, you know, their daily interactions at work or whatever other relationships, try to bring that anarchist kind of practice and whatever vision they might have into play. But it's just disconnected. And as a result, there is no anarchist movement, quote unquote, to speak of. You know, there's isolated groups of people. You know, and people hang out and get together, but there are attempts being made because of kind of these long-standing relationships that have been informal for a while. You know, there's been discussion about, well, how do we get out of the sorry state of affairs into something that at least we can raise the flag, we can constitute ourselves as a pole, as a trend. You know, we can raise the profile, so to speak, of anti-authoritarianism, but at the same time, for some of us, try to give it more of a class orientation, but not based solely on like any caricature of class. A class orientation, anarchist trend that can at least intersect and engage on a range of social struggles that are here and will continue to emerge. Hence, like actually tonight, the meeting you're at tonight is one of the pretty much first explicitly anarchist events that's happened in some time in Detroit, maybe even a couple years that I know of, you know, beyond like maybe shows, punk shows, poetry sessions, which are all cool and we need things like that, but they don't attempt to move beyond kind of the cultural scenes. They're not trying to cohere like a vision or politics or say, hey, or at least engage people and stimulate that discussion about, here we are, what are we going to do? You know, we're not going away. The problems of the city aren't going away. We're committed to these ideas. You know, we need to be doing more than just being anarchists at work or in our personal relationships.
Do you want to talk about Solidarity and Defense?
It's groping its way along. You know, this event's being done in its name. There's been several meetings. There is a bit of a momentum and development and a group cohering, though not so much in Detroit here yet, but is up in Lansing. There are plans with the movement of individuals to try and build another leg down here, so we're standing on two legs. There's a lot of discussion needs. It was conceived somewhat because in a whole number of events that have happened in the past period with some mobilizations against Nazi provocations in cities around here and the counter demonstrations. More recently, the bringing in of Nick Griffin from the BNP to MSU, but also going to the resistance to the major, you know, attacks and lowering of and just slashing in the auto industry. There was a kind of, opposition from below born called Soldiers Against Solidarity, trying to go out and support them and become more aware of the developments there and make links with people. There was some stuff about some killings and violence against women up in Lansing. This informal network came together, collaborating on that, sometimes playing a serious role in getting mobilizations together, but while pulling people together, not there being cohered politically and putting out any kind of anarchist viewpoint in it, but sometimes pulling out other forces as part of the United Front who were putting out their limited or, to our point of view, incorrect political viewpoint. And it was sort of like, hey, we got to be getting our politics out. We need to formalize this informal network. And so we kind of did it on this basis of grouping together people who we knew had, an anarchist or anti-authoritarian vibe, but we didn't want it, we thought we couldn't at this time anything that has too much programmatically together, but try and formalize and at least get some aspect of anti-authoritarian politics out there and have an organized expression at these events we played a big role in, but other people have been able to take advantage of. I have good feelings about it, but it's really a work in progress and in its infancy.
Part of it, there's a couple tensions, kind of with the political one. For some of us, myself in particular, some of the better political experiences has been over the years in the anti-fascist organizing. ARA was a generally, not exclusive, but generally a Midwest phenomenon. We had branches on the East Coast, we had people on the West Coast, important branches. We had groups in Canada, out in the West, then you had groups in Toronto, around the place. But the life of it, the life of the organization has never really been researched. A lot of people who weren't in it or came later didn't really understand the workings, but it was a mass formation. There was debate, there was dialogue. You could, at conferences, you could have 500, 600, you could even have 800 to 1,000 people that would pass through the weekend conferences. And you had, while it was generally anti-authoritarian, groups like Love and Rage played a major role in trying to keep the movement transparent and democratic. It wasn't exclusively anarchist with a big A. But it was a big experiment, and for a lot of people in the 90s, it was their first taste of being part of something semi-mass and something in which you could travel from city to city and meet up with people, participate, talk stuff out, and it was very educational. That collapsed a couple of years back, and really about 2 years before the Seattle protests. With the collapse of stuff like ARA and simultaneously Love and Rage, a lot of people who had been in the anarchist movement just kind of left. They went on to do other stuff, Even good ones, might have said, well, I want to have a class perspective. I want to be doing direct action stuff. Maybe I'll become a staff union organizer and join the AFL-CIO or, SEIU or Unite Here or something like that. And they would take that experience they had, but then they just translate it to get out of the anarchist movements and apply it to something else.
Yeah, and people didn't just go on their own and vote. That last big Chicago conference and stuff, Unite, the union, sent young people in and were using the labor workshop and any interest in going in that direction to actively recruit people to sign on to Unite projects under the control of the union that seem young and exciting. And they purposely came in, because in that workshop, I was like boxed in a corner, and even though I was one of the people that had extensive working class and had some ideas to do, they boxed you off. And so there was some aspect of raiding, going on.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to overplay that. But the biggest thing was ARA had done so much and some really even brilliant and exciting actions along with a bunch of goofier ones on the anti-fascist stuff, and there was a lot of good feeling there. But everybody across the board knew it had to become a more multifaceted organization. But the organization, and part with people's experience and stuff, couldn't conduct a civil discussion.
Right.
And instead, what happened was, and since the organization didn't have, you know, it actually driven its target, the fascists, underground a bit, and didn't have the target, the organization stalled a bit,
mm-hmm.
and then people were finding little personal squabbles, some serious, you know, so I don't want to minimize what they were, but it was like what in past movements we call them, when you're in a relatively small, hyped up group, the telephone booth effect, this person's elbows in this person's eye, this foot in your mouth, and you're all packed in there, and it started to be, you're the reason we're not growing onward enough, we've no, you're the reason, and it got quite vicious.
But what
and
part of
broke down?
What
know?
Mike's saying too is that it's ARA was great on so many levels, and a lot of people got experience. But its program was very limited, and even though there was beyond the anti-fascists, there was lots of other projects, and a lot of stuff was done that wasn't anti-fascist, but it was done under ARA's name. You could even pro-labor stuff, you know. Pro-choice work, you know, it was still generally anti-fascist movement. And when the fascist stuff kind of, for lots of different reasons, kind of retreated or went underground, ARA just kind of dissipated. So with the solidarity and defense thing, what we've wanted to try to do is, instead of creating a specific anarchist organization like a platformist group or something out of that tradition, even though we respect it and ourselves as initiators of the project would even align with that tradition or have come out of it, we wanted to create a class-oriented, revolutionary, radical, anti-authoritarian direct action project that wasn't that kind of took the best from the ARA experience, drew from lessons of that and a range of other kinds of direct action projects, but give it a higher level of politics, but without going so high that it's a unitary, specific organization. Like, you can join. Like, if we're developing a program, we have ideas. If you like it, then hey, come around to our events. You know, we want to try to put on, like, tonight and in the future, start doing things like red and black forums where we have, like, educational events. You know, we might have panels of speakers coming from different projects. And it's a way for people to plug in, whether they're old, you know, have been around the scenes a while and are interested again, or people who are new. You know, want to create that space to renew and kind of reinvent that interest and that dynamic quality that we're lacking. So you don't have to agree to point 1 through 10, you know, and you don't have to be a specific, I'm a this, 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 or this. But we want to try to create, nonetheless, through the work, a political poll. You know, it's not something that's generic. It's not something that is all-inclusive. If you don't agree with it, that's okay. We can still work together, but you don't have to join. We can figure out ways. Part of, you know, when we call it solidarity and defense, it's to attempt to reach out and extend solidarity to a range of struggles. We don't have to agree with everything on every point, but we think in this time and age, with all the attacks that are going through, it's important to kind of back each other up and create those new spaces for dialogue and whatever may come out of that in forms of experimentation and joint work. So I think,
we kind of conceive of it as a general defense, general resistance organization, which, since everything's been so atomized, individuals and barely any groupings, so people can come together as some kind of committee/network, as loosey-goosey as that sounds, and start to collaborate on having some kind of general resistance and back some kind of presence that's anti-authoritarian, because all the serious organizing, albeit how small because of the sad state affairs around here, most of the stuff, whether anti-war, labor, and this and that, still the factions playing a key role and starting to attract some younger people to them or stuff, are by and large organizations of the authoritarian left, and I mean authoritarian with a capital A, and they've kind of hid that history from people.
Absolutely.
They've sort of, like, as a learning process, they've adopted certain things where they seem to have a more democratic, and they're not as piggy as they were in the past, but they haven't really learned anything. And we could see the rise of an authoritarian left in new clothes all over again with a little bit.
Well, even post anti-globalization, you know, the first couple of years of that, where you had a lot of the left, I kind of break it down three ways, you know, with the whole period, you know, pre and after Seattle, there were segments of the left, the Marxist and the, you know, social democratic and whatnot, who actually looked at this new movement and said, we haven't rethought our ideas in 20 years. Now we're presented with this new movement. It's dynamic. People are going to it. And I think some segments of the left seriously wanted to figure out how to break away from the orthodoxy that existed, the legalistic, you know, the left that was about attacking policies of capital rather than capitalism in the state in general. And so some segments of the authoritarian left actually went through a period of internal criticism and extended hands and worked with the new anarchist movement, you know, the new anarchist movement. Other segments of the left wrapped themselves in the clothing and the guise of the new anti-globalization, anti-capitalist movement. But in the last couple of years, with the whole downturn of that anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movement, those segments that had previously just kind of gave lip service to collectivity, socialism from below, participatory politics, have reemerged once again and said, see, those experiments, they don't work. You know, our ideas 20 years ago have proven there's problems, but they work better than the anarchist movement. And so, like I said earlier, you know, those of us committed to these ideas, we're not going away. We want to figure out a way to, you know, kind of continue it and strike out and create a voice to not compete, but to say, hey, this is our ideas, this is our principle, this is who we're bringing out, this is what we're doing, so that, you know, we just don't hand over the playing field to a range of authoritarian, social democratic, and basically organizations, movements, which don't care about their movement's input or participation. We just want people to just suck them in.
The question I'm traditionally ending these interviews with is asking people what they make of the U.S. election.
We've debated this back and forth. We're pretty much on similar pages, but it's...
Bob, number one, it's just interesting for America that a black guy could end up being president. That'd be a big deal, even though it's really going to make no difference for black people or anybody else. I mean, I don't want to say totally no difference, but not any fundamental difference. So he's certainly not going to undermine the system as we know it and head towards any kind of new thing, and stuff. But a lot of people, I don't feel like it's useful to go out there. I want to say what I think about it and that the whole system got to go, capitalist, the whole electoral stuff to me is a farce. But I don't want to invest any energy or, after saying what I think, beating anybody over the head that they want to go exercise their vote and do it. Because I think, given the low level of politics of a lot of people, particularly a lot of newer, the younger generation, I think it would be better for them to get what they want and get over it. And then being a product of the 60s myself on some level, I think it bodes well for having a more radical revolutionary left if the quote liberals and those types are in power and show their bankruptcy. And as long as we still get one parade of more or less right-wing government, I think the liberals and some of their politics are going to keep a grip on and continue to weaken the movement, and I'd rather have them in power to expose them, though I certainly can't even stomach the thought of voting for him or urging anything. I mean, I find it both not only morally but aesthetically repugnant, you know. But that's all.
But it's this never-ending cycle. I mean, I do think with the last 8 years of the Bush administration, or Bush being representative of one faction of the ruling class, you know, domestic, international, people are tired of it. People want something. People want a little bit more, better speaking, someone who thinks more broadly, someone who's going to be different. And I have no illusions that the Democrats offer any alternative, really, when it comes down to it. But I don't think that takes away from people who don't come from a left background going, I want something different. Now, I think the mistake that some segments of the left are making is that they want to take that enthusiasm and that hunger, and they want to get out there and vote Democrat, you know, and they think that's going to be a way to make connections and work, you know, and raise their flag. But I think in some levels it's a bit not some levels, but it's quite dishonest, because, you know, these are people having criticisms, but they're not going to voice it because they think, well, you know, people aren't going to understand our criticisms or whatnot. I think, though, with the Obama stuff in particular, there is a lot of people who listen to him speak, and he is quite a good speaker, you know, whether or not the content of it is good or not. He's quite a good speaker, and he's younger, he's, you know, and he's black, you know. And I think a lot of people go, well, hey, that's not all bad considering what we've got. But people haven't done the investigative work. They haven't read. They actually don't know what he says. They don't really listen to what he says. He's actually quite conservative, you know, and he's attempted to triangulate, you know, place himself above the Republicans and Democrats. But on one breath, he talks and can raise and generate this discussion about race in America. And there's some legitimate and good things that he said in that speech a couple weeks back. But on the other hand, he talks, well, we need to, like Reagan helped move America and bring America together against the excesses of the 60s and 70s. Well, people don't think about what that means, and what were the excesses of the 60s and 70s? It was the civil rights movements, the black liberation struggle. Reagan basically brought together a coalition against those reforms and that mentality that shook America's foundations. And there was this backlash against it, and Reagan cohered that. And so Obama's saying, well, you know, that was a good thing, you know? And so people just are not paying attention. And the other thing about it, this is what I've been arguing a lot with Democrats and leftists, is the whole issue of the war. Democrats have an imperial agenda. It might be a social democratic or left imperial agenda, but nonetheless, it's an imperial agenda. They are not anti-war. You listen to Obama, you listen to Clinton, it's all like, you know, talking, couched in this redirecting of forces, drawdowns and whatnot. But then what's connected with it? We're going to focus back on Afghanistan. People keep forgetting about Afghanistan. People keep forgetting about that is a war situation too. So people have this hope that by electing this party into power, it's going to be an ending of the imperial adventure abroad, but it's not. It's just it's a new configuration of it, and I think that's thrown a lot of people who want something different into a tailspin because they want something different. But the two major candidates, pretty much similar on all policies, and when it comes down to it, they are professed for the war abroad and basically keeping capital together. Keeping global capitalism, trying to figure out how to put a band-aid on it from it fraying and breaking apart internationally. I'm with Mike. I wouldn't say I want to go out and argue and tell people don't vote because I think that'd be a waste of time. But I do think that this election might open up space for social revolutionaries, revolutionary anarchists, to talk about the broader issues at hand. And I think in particular, get back to the discussion about the war in its fullest and total meaning.